Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Sweet. And the Ballroom Blitz. That was released as a single in September 1973 on RCA Records in Europe. And then 20 months later, it was released on Capitol Records in the US of A. And it went to number one in Canada, number two in the UK singles charts, and also in Australia, and number five on the US Billboard Hot 100. And the song appeared on the US and Canadian versions of their third album, Desolation Boulevard, but it never appeared on a Sweet album in the UK other than hits compilations. There you go, sunshine.
The Sweet.
Yep.
Now, of course, you won't remember these guys.
Well, hang on, what year? Well,
73.
Maybe on Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
When I was, like, wearing nappies.
Well, on Top of the Pops, I remember seeing them, and it was a very sort of You know, the bass player was very effeminate, and in those days it was quite outrageous, you know, for that. And they were all dressed up in glam rock gear, and I dismissed it as nonsense.
Did you now?
Completely.
Ooh,
pop
Mr.
nonsense.
Campbell.
I didn't like it because 73, I was wanting to Wishbone Ash and heavy, you know, and Zeppelin and all those things, and I thought this was absolutely ridiculous. Tripe, no less. Tripe. But listening back now, and I did actually, I don't know if I got the single, I never bought it, but I've got it kicking around there in vinyl. And listening to it, the Sweet actually are a great rock and roll band. The guitar player, you know, is really good. And all the B-sides, I think they were pretty clever. Andy Scott is the guitar player.
Okay.
And the B-sides, they used to write their own material and put it on the other side because, of course, as far as royalties go, the B-side earns as much as an A-side.
Of course.
Mm. So, you know, but Chin and Chapman, who were the masters of recording cheesy, super mega cheesy stuff, and they you know, did stuff for all sorts of people, didn't they? Mud.
Yeah.
And I think they wrote for a lot of those sort of people.
Oh, well, it was produced by the guy called Phil Wayman, and he did the Boomtown Rats, I Don't Like Monday. Mondays, plural, I should say, and also work with the Bay City Rollers, XTC.
XTC, great band.
XTC.
Yeah, very.
And I like Bay City Rollers as well, and I like Boomtown Rats. Yeah.
But if you ever get an opportunity to listen to the Sweet, I think if you listen to the B-sides and some of their other stuff, it's actually good. And Andy was, you know, as I say, he's a great guitar player. And the band, really tight drummer, and very, very punchy sound on that, you know. And even now, I can honestly say, if you stick that at a disco anywhere in the world, is that an old way of saying it, a disco?
Yeah, a disco.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Or in a club or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
People would leap to the dance floor.
Yeah.
It's like sticking on something by Erasure or something like that.
Oh,
where you
of
get
course.
People leaping on there and actually grooving out.
With a sequin codpiece. You're out there at the front.
Oh, baby, sequin
no,
codpiece.
No, remember we watched Andy Bell in Erasure, and honestly, he was so fantastic on stage. He was such a performer. I love that guy. What I found with these guys, though, they were smart, though, because they kind of took advantage of that British glam rock fad. And so they were just a little bit more radio-friendly than, like, T-Rex at the time, or maybe Gary Glitter.
Yep.
So they had that kind of more bubble gum, but they were actually smart about it, I think, and they found a niche and they just milked it, really.
Well, they did.
And had a career out of it, and why not? I mean, as you say, they're catchy tunes, and that's it.
Yeah.
Good on them. Oh, I found out something else about this song, you know. It's actually written about a real incident.
No.
Yeah, because this is lovely, right? On the 27th of January, 1973, the band were performing at the Grand Hall in Kilmarnock in Scotland.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, and it's called Barroom Blitz because they were basically driven off stage by a barrage of bottles.
Well, I think that this track also tinges it slightly with sadness. Brian Connolly, who's the singer, died, it's quite a few years ago now, and there was a heart-wrenching documentary on the TV about him.
Yeah. About
how...
I didn't see that.
Yeah, it was absolutely awful. He drove himself into drug abuse and alcoholism really, really badly, and it showed some performances towards the end of his life, you know, and it was just terrible. You know, because they went superstars, and then all of a sudden, you know, like all pop bands or a lot of pop bands, they cease to become superstars and become stars, and then they become has-beens.
Well, the thing is, you know what, you just don't believe. I mean, what you do, you just live for the moment, but you always keep your feet on the ground. That's what you got to do because, you know, we all know we're going, we might have different routes, but we're all going to the same destination.
Mm. Easier said than done. We'll be right back. Wishbone Ash, The King Will Come, from their third album, Argus, released on the 28th of April, 1972, on the Decca MCA label, peaked at number three in the UK album chart, and named Album of the Year in Sounds Mag 1972. And you know what? You know what?
Yeah, I'm not saying anything.
Wishbone Ash started it all for me.
I know.
Andy Powell was the man. That's why I picked up the guitar. I wanted to look cool with a flying V like him. And I wanted to sound just like that. Right? And, you know, listening back, I don't think that the lyrics and a lot of the stuff that the, you know, the album pushes forward and, you know, really wears well with time. However, the guitar sounds certainly wear well with time because they are beautiful.
They do. You're so right there.
They're not distorted. You see, everybody's got too much bloody distortion on their guitars. They're mad for it.
Yeah.
They want it crunching. They want it sustaining. They want to sound like Carlos Santana or something all the time. That isn't how you do it.
No.
This is how you do it. And I, you know, Facebook, you like it, hate it. But, you know, I like it because I've managed to connect with some of my complete all-time heroes. And Andy Powell, I connected with some years ago now. And Andy is such a lovely bloke.
He is.
And
he's a top man.
Yeah, and he's helped a lot of our friends, you know, the Pipe brothers, Jamie Pipe, who plays keyboards. They were on the tour. The Mentals, that's the band.
Yeah.
They went around and supported Andy. And he's been a source of information, you know. I met him and we rocked up
in Germany, didn't we? And
yeah.
He was there and he was so gracious and just, well, he was just natural. It's like, hi, come on in, da, da, da. Really
good. And he invited
good.
Us backstage before the gig, which is normally a no-no.
Yeah.
He was absolutely great. I'm back afterwards. And what a cool guy. We got his book, we gave him a CD and stuff, so we had a bit of a swap. And it was a lovely time, you know. And when I met him, I couldn't help but being a fanboy because I couldn't speak. I went, oh, it's Andy Powell. Oh, no, I'm going to say no. But what he did do in a conversation quite a long time ago now, he shared with me how actually and what amps they used on this recording. And do you think they used Orange or anything like that? No, they used old Fenders. And
right.
He had I think it was a Les Paul with P90s on.
Okay, the pickups, yeah.
Pickups, yeah, when he was actually recording this, which is exactly the same as I've got now. And I didn't buy it because of that. It's just the fact that I always thought it was a cool guitar, you know. It was only Flying V's that he started using.
Yeah.
He used them live. But it was, you know, but when they were doing the earlier stuff and all those great guitar sounds from Wishbone Ash, the original album of Pilgrimage, you know, we're all done those. And, of course, he then started using Matamp later on.
Mm.
Which we went to see Jeff from Matt.
Grumpy Jeff, he's not grumpy once he sticks the kettle on and tells you lots of stories. He's a fascinating chap and he is a mine of information.
And also, I think, you know, and I'm sticking my neck out here, but I actually think that he's the most original British guitar valve and bass valve making company, amplifier company.
Yeah, I'd agree with you actually.
He is original.
Yeah.
You know, he worked with Matt Mathias, who designed Matamp. He worked on all the Orange stuff, you know, and they still make them like they used to. There's been no changes except the Transformers. They can't get Partridge Transformers down. It's all technical, but they can't get those down. They're having the Transformers rework. But they really know what they're doing.
The thing is, when you and Jeff talk, and I do know some stuff, but really this is your passion. But you get each other in a grip and you talk about stuff. And the thing is that you take no prisoners. It's like, and the thing is that you're not kind to each other in that way. It's like, well, that sounds shit. And you'll say that's a bad sound or whatever. And you don't talk to each other to get on with each other. You're just saying what you know and what you love.
Yeah.
And the thing is that you two get on so well because you have exactly the same opinions about so many things. I mean, we did that the speaker test the other day. I mean, it's perfect. Your chat's just, it's lovely, you know. It really is inspiring. It's great to meet somebody who you can talk to who actually knows what they're talking about instead of giving you a load of baloney.
Well, that's right. And I think that I think we are going to go with Matam live because I think you need an alternative to your high watt, you know, because obviously we need a second amp and stuff. Because we were looking at the tone circuit on your high watt and making course, yeah, and making sure it was sort of compatible. And the Orange said it great. Sorry, the Matamp said it great.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was using one that was absolutely fantastic. But back to Wishbone Ash.
Oh, yes, because we love Wishbone Ash.
And, you know, and I think I said this last time we had a Wishbone Ash. We haven't had a lot of Wishbone Ash on, considering how much I love this band and how much I love this album. I do a whole show on Wishbone Ash.
I know, that's why I'm talking, because I actually just want you to talk about them. But I like the fact that I just want to tell you this story and you can carry on. But what I was fascinated by, you know, that serendipity of luck or of meeting of people.
Yeah.
Now, so their manager was Miles Copeland III, who was also the manager later on for The Police and Sting, because he's Stuart Copeland's brother.
Correct.
Yeah. So he got Wishbone Ash a break by, and he got them an opening spot for Deep Purple. And Richie Blackmore from Deep Purple later recommended Wishbone Ash to producer Derek Lawrence.
Right.
Right. And then, and he also helped them secure a record deal with Decca and MCA. So isn't that incredible?
Well, as you know, and if anybody's listened to the show for a long time, they will know that Derek Lawrence actually produced Little Brother album. And
your album, basically. Yeah, Little Brother. The thing is, I was saying to you the other day, it's like, you know, yes, Little Brother was your band and you got a great record deal with Polydor, and Derek Lawrence produced your album.
Correct. And it was amazing.
And Martin, big Jim Sullivan was there, wasn't he?
He was.
Kicking your ass.
But we've talked about it before, so I don't want to go into it. But Martin Birch also was actually the engineer on this. He worked with Purple a lot. And it's this big family again. But the sound on that record is absolutely fantastic. And it was done at Delane Studios, where Deep Purple did a lot of the stuff, you know. So anyway, you know, they are a great band. Great guitar tones. Very sensitive. I love the way that they play. And, you know, I just love it. Love it, love it, love it.
Leaves were falling just like embers. In colors red.
Killing the Blues, the Grammy award-winning collaboration album Raising Sand by rock singer Rob Plant and bluegrass country singer Alison Krauss. And that was released on the 23rd of October in 2007 on the Rounder record label.
Now, anybody that listens to the show regularly will know we don't play a lot of modern stuff.
Nope.
Because we don't think it's actually any good. We think it's actually merde.
See.
Scheiße.
Yeah.
But this is a considerable exception. We've talked about Rob Plant before. We've had some from his stuff from his, you know, Band of Joy and all that sort of stuff on, and his solo stuff. And what, you know, even though Jimmy Page was born on the same date as me, you know, 9th of January, you know, I do think that he is, I mean, he's a curator of Led Zeppelin's material, and but he's obsessed with Zeppelin. That was his greatest, I mean, and you can't argue, it was the biggest band in the world.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And he's doing that, but he's never really done anything outside Zeppelin. I don't think it's really been any good, to tell you the truth. I think most of it's been crap, honestly. And, you know, because Led Zeppelin were Led Zeppelin when they were together, and that was it, and they were unbelievable. Rob Plant, however, has gone on and done a lot of other stuff.
Mm.
And when I heard this for the first time, I went out and bought it immediately on vinyl, because I wanted to hear it on vinyl. I listened to it, and I thought, God, that's incredibly compressed. The whole sound very, very compressed. And if you look at the waveform, because we're using Pro Tools to record our show here, it's like flat. It's like a Metallica record. It's so flat. In terms of dynamic,
right. Yeah.
But T-Bone Walker on this, as a producer, has done something extra.
T-Bone Burnett.
Oh, T-Bone Burnett. Sorry, T-Bone Walker. Sorry about that. But T-Bone Burnett, yeah. He, you know, he's done something extraordinary on this. And the mix, he played a lot of guitar on it. The tremolo guitar is sensational. The sound of everything is beautiful. And we know that he T-Bone Burnett used some of his own Valve U47 Neumann microphones to record this. But the interesting thing is that they did it all through preamps. And what they did is that they had a load of individual preamps that they recorded, all the instruments, and put it down onto tape, and then remixed through the Neve board at Sound Emporium in Nashville.
Yeah.
Now, what I do love about it is that, and I know I'm going on a bit there, but you know about I love production.
Art, isn't it? Because what you're trying to do is find the best way to convey the heartbeat of someone being alive. And that's what I think the skill of a sound engineer is, you know, and a producer. You're trying to capture the magic of the moment.
Well, absolutely right. And Mike Piacente, who actually is T-Bone Burnett's main engineer that he uses for a remix engineer and mix engineer, he said, we still mix to an analog console. For us, nothing sounds better to our ears, so we will stick with what we know and like. Now, what's wrong with that? Absolutely nothing. You know, because they're using a beautiful, say, Neve, what's it, 81 series?
Yeah. Exactly, and he was working on projects after that as well, or just before with B.B. King and stuff. So they were doing that, you know, and that's the way he worked. And as soon as I read that, I was like, I'm so like you, I want to meet him. You know, just because he's got the same ethos and it feels kindred spirit.
Yeah, and the drums sound so delicious on this, you know, and the bass guitar. And it is hyper-compressed, but in this album, it really works.
Mm.
And you know, their vocals together, I think, are quite delightful. And we were talking about this, because a lot of misinformation about this record.
They never met,
but that's not right, is it?
No, because I was a bit surprised. So I actually went into Mixmag and had a look at this, because I was quite interested in having talked about the compression on the album. I wanted to know exactly what happened because, you know, fact, it's important to get it right. Because I thought, and I'd read that they hadn't met and they were just sort of sending files over, but they didn't. T-Bone had them at like their vocal booths, like 45 degrees, so they could see each other. And they recorded over 2 or 3 weeks and they got on like a house on fire. And there was one moment when, I mean, the thing is as well, they were experimenting with different mic techniques and I didn't put that in the notes just because it's not important. What they were doing is they were really keen on making it work. But this whole album was curated. So the songs were chosen, well, created by T-Bone Burnett, and also obviously Rob Plant and Alison Krauss had a say in the final songs. But they experimented with sounds. And there was one time they were talking about Alison Krauss kind of wasn't feeling it. And she just went into some sort of, she was playing violin, and she started going to some sort of Led Zeppelin song on her violin. So Rob jumped up and started singing with her in this thing. And then someone came in with like a keyboard. I think it was T-Bone and a little keyboard. And they, well, or drum or something. And they were just like, it's being recorded. They were just messing because they're kids. And they were keeping it fresh.
And that's great. But they certainly have a chemistry. And what I do like about it is that the way that the mix is taking place, in the fact that her vocal on this particular track is
slightly back. Get out of my head.
But it's
I was going to say that.
And she's doing that upper harmony, but because of the sound and the way they've got it compressed, it just sits beautiful with his vocal.
It feels like it's almost like put a slight delay on her, because she's almost like, you know, when I play bass on some tracks and I'll go back and I slouch back like two-thirds, three-thirds. For me, it's like a three things. And I'm sloppy with it. And I felt like she was doing this kind of whole vocal bass thing where she was just keeping the groove back. Really, just it's so
it's
almost
yeah.
it almost so they weren't perfectly together on every single word, and it gives this really sloppy but kind of really nice feel to it. It's really chilled.
Well, it works, and the whole album's fantastic. And I think we'll be playing some more tracks from this,
well, you
this
know,
album. It's one of our favourites, isn't it?
Yeah. It actually won a 5 Grammys, this album, you know, unsurprisingly. The only thing is, as well, I think sometimes it's like, and I think that Rob Plant's a bit like Dumbledore from Harry Potter. I don't know, there's some wisdom with this guy because he's curious and I like him for that. But they started working on a second album, him and Alison, and they started in 2009. But a year later, he just said that the follow-up sessions
didn't have the magic. Yeah.
No, so you know, they both, I think what's beautiful sometimes is to leave it and move on.
Thank you.
John Mayall and the Blues Breakers, The Stumble, from their third album, second studio album, A Hard Road.
A Hard Road.
Released on the 17th of February 1967 on Decca Records in the UK and London Records in the USA.
Yeah.
Now, Peter Green.
Yes.
The greatest British blues guitar player. Sorry, Eric. Sorry. But
he is.
By a country mile.
You can tell.
He interprets the chords beautifully. He doesn't just play over the changes. He's listening. And what I love about that, he makes mistakes. And when we go back, you can hear him going, you can hear him thinking. You can hear the smoke coming out of his ears, you know, when he's actually doing it, you know, when he's going around those chords. And those beautiful phrases and lines, they are delicious. And his sound is like, he always had a very clean, trebly sound. And you know... and again, he started using Matt Amps later, and he was using Matt Amps with Wishbone Ash. That's right, yeah.
Okay.
Whereas Eric went on the Marshall route, Peter Green wanted something cleaner and more. I can't remember what he said. He said he wanted it warm and beautiful rather than. I can't remember the actual. I'm going to look it up and I might talk about it later on. But anyway,
okay. Yeah.
But you know, John Mayall on vocals and guitar, harmonica, piano, organ as normal. Peter Green lead guitar, John McVie on bass, and Ainsley Dunbar on drums. Of course,
get in there.
Yeah,
I didn't realise as well that John Mayall did the artwork for that album. Would you believe The Hard Road?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was a blues classic written by Sonny Thompson and Freddie King, and it was first recorded in 1961, on Freddie King's album, Let's Hide Away and Dance Away with Freddie King. I love that. I love that so much.
Jeez.
But it was so, anyway, so John Mayall and the Blues Breakers, that went to number 8 in the UK album charts, recorded at Decca Studios and produced by
Mike Vernon.
Well, we kind of know about that because Mike's all around that time, which is fantastic, you know.
Yeah, we've played a lot of stuff by Mike Vernon, and he's, you know, he's a great producer, and he was, and also I think he was very, very, he had a lot of foresight about the scene, and he actually
good people person by the sounds of it,
and he really helped Peter Green because he signed him on his label, with, you know, and he with Fleetwood Mac and.
Do you know what? And anybody who's done that, you just go, good egg. And I look forward to meeting him. We've yet to cross paths, but I'm sure we'll be at a festival in Germany or somewhere at the same point and say hello. I've got to tell you a little bit of triv as well. I love this as well. I did not know. You know, when Eric Clapton was in the Blues Breakers before Pete Green, do you know why he left? Well, I didn't know this. Was because he went to see Buddy Guy in concert, and Buddy Guy had a trio at the time, and he got this idea to form his own trio, which was Cream. So he left after seeing a Buddy Guy concert and formed Cream with Ginger Baker and Jack Bruce. And that's when Pete Green came in and replaced Clapton.
Yeah, what a second fiddle, eh?
Turning tables instead.
You're listening to the Supertones Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was the Alan Parsons Project and a song called Eye in the Sky from their sixth studio album, Eye in the Sky, released in June 1982 by Arista Records. And it was also released as a single in August that year, a couple of months later. And do you know, by October, it was number three in the Billboard charts in the USA, number one in both Canada and Spain, and number six in New Zealand. And it was their most successful release ever.
Recorded at Abbey Road, where, of course, he recorded with Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon.
Of course.
Because Alan Parsons was the engineer, and they actually credited him, saying he was a very important contributor. But after that, he left.
I know.
He didn't do Wish You Were Here, which is, I think, our both favourite Floyd album.
That's true.
And, you know, but he went on to... And, you know, Alan Parsons, the Alan Parsons Project, it sounds a bit like a British Steely Dan to me.
Yeah, that's brilliant, actually. I've not thought of it like that. I've just been thinking about it.
Right, and the guitar player. It's all about the guitar player, this band. Ian Bernstein, right, is like the British Larry Carlton. Really.
Right, okay.
Very similar. And he's played in a lot of stuff. And in my, you know, in the dark, distant past, I've got a single by Pilot.
Ah.
And Magic is one of them. And January.
Whoa, it's magic.
Exactly. But you listen to January. There's that beautiful do-do-do, do-do-do, and it's a beautiful guitar line that he does on that. And he started off as a session guitar player and he's playing with the Bay City Rollers.
No.
Was Ian Bernstein. Yeah, but anyway.
Shut that door.
He's a Scottish dude and he moved to Spain. And we missed him by about 2 months. And when we moved to Valencia, people said, oh, you need to go and meet Ian. And he'd left. He got back to England.
I remember. Can I just say, though, you're talking about it being like the British Steely Dan, but I thought about it not for the guitar, but because of the harmonies. All through that track, he has melted me. It's almost like eating chocolate for me. The same response that I get when I have a great bar of chocolate or a great vanilla ice cream. Listening to those harmonies melt over your heart, like you can't live without it. It feels so, it's just beautiful.
Yeah, the production techniques. I mean, the things about Alan Parsons, he doesn't actually really do a right lot. I mean, he played Fairlight on this. He engineers, produces it. He wrote some of it, or wrote, you know, with Eric Wolfson. Who actually does the singing on this.
Right.
And so Alan Parsons, he just hangs around. And when you ever see the band, I mean, I've watched a couple of videos. And it's a bit soft for me. It's not really? Like really rock and roll enough for me.
I think it appears to my sort of romantic comedy side, which you have to watch occasionally just because I watch some of your blood gore horror ones. So we balance it out. But
I do
have a soft spot for great harmony.
I know our friend Mark Cleeter in the Isle of Man, he loves Alan Parsons. He loves Ian Bernstein.
I did not know that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Are you really? Cleeter loves them.
Oh, yeah.
Well, this would not really be my choice of band, by the way. Can I just say it? Because, and you know, we know Mark loves Ultravox and is a complete Meteor fan. But there's something, there's a concept with Alan Parsons that I didn't realise. When you look into it, it kind of helps you get the context of it. That at the time, what they wanted to do was, because films at the time were sort of like Kubrick and Hitchcock, with the promotion of the movie industry, it was more about the directors and the film stars. So what they had this concept, because I know that Parsons was a bit frustrated sometimes with some of the musicians that he worked with, that they interfered with the creative process. He wanted free rein creatively. And so they started this project sort of with that aspect, that you would focus more on the sort of, you know, the producer type side of it more than the star kind of thing. Mm. So he got to actually create his vision.
A bit like T-Bone Burnett earlier on, really.
Yeah. So when you think that, I mean, yes, it is a bit twee, but to me, those vocals just melt me. Yes, it's kind of almost a little bit, you know, a couple of steps away from Footloose, you know, and, you know, that kind of like cheesy 80s stuff. I get that completely. But for this song, when you listen to it just on its own without really... I've just really enjoyed those harmonies, and I'm a sucker for a great harmony.
You are. Later. Straub's Lay Down released a single on 13th of October 1972, where it peaked at number 12 in the UK singles charts. It was included on their fifth studio album, Bursting at the Seams, released 3 months later on A&M Records, where it went to number 2 in the UK albums charts.
That's a pretty good achievement, hey?
Well, I love this song. It's been my earworm ever since we programmed it about a week ago. And what do you think? You don't like it? I can't believe it. All I've been doing is singing this song.
Well, it doesn't move me the same. And it's not about not liking it. It's just that, I don't know, sometimes in life you just kind of want a bit more oomph or something. And I don't know. I'm not saying they're a bad band or anything. And I actually really, you know, I think they're pretty good. And I'd like to hear more of their stuff, you know, and get to know them more. I'm just getting more into this kind of more rock rooted thing at the moment. Well, and even though I'm a folky, which is really weird.
Well, the thing about this band is that they came out of that folk scene, really. You know, and which was completely different than their contemporaries, like the Moody Blues, Kings Crimson and Pink Floyd at that time.
Yeah, no, I get that.
And it was different. But, you know, our mate, incidentally, Dave Bainbridge, is working with them now.
I know. And, you know, I'd love to see them live. And I'm sure they're fantastic. It's just that, at this moment in time, emotionally, I don't have the same response. And then probably in 6 months or a year time, I'll be listening going, I love this song. It's not just, it's not, when we talk about this music, it's where you're at the time and what it is you're into, surely, you know? Because there are certain things that date and certain things you discover again, you know?
I think to me, the songwriting on this is great. I love it. I think it's a great, and actually the instrumental sections, I don't think the guitar, you know, the solos are not great, and the bass player loses his way about two-thirds of the way through. He makes a bit of a cock-up towards the end of one of the verses, you know. But I think the song is extremely strong, and I love it a lot.
Good for
a
you.
A lot.
And I do like the fact that Rick Wakeman was in the band as well. That kind of makes me feel better about them.
Yeah,
and Sandy Denny was with them for a while before she joined Fairport.
And they were the first UK group signings on Herb Alpert's A&M.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So get you. So it's nearly time to finish the show, by the way, darling.
No.
Yeah.
I don't want to stop.
No. Well, the thing is, our weekly date has to come to an end because we've got some movies to watch and dinner to eat because our son Joe's cooking his dinner tonight.
Right. Well, so, we're going to finish off with Roy Orbison. Now,
yes.
Roy Orbison is my favourite US singer, male singer.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I've never heard you say that before.
Better than Elvis. I prefer him. You know, and I love the, yes, true. And the end bit of this, when he cranks up right to those big notes right at the end, they are magnificent. I love it. He was in the Traveling Wilburys. I've always loved him. I loved, you know, everything he's done. This is Crying, released as a 45 in 1961 on Monument Records. Went to number one, obviously.
Yes, but it only got to number two in the Billboard Hot 100 charts because Ray Charles was number one, kept him off the top spot with Hit the Road Jack.
Well, you know, Scotty Moore's on this as well. So.
Oh, I knew, do you know what, I put that down on the note. I was thinking, right, okay, I'm just going to list all the band members here. And I thought, I knew you'd pick out Scotty Moore on guitar, as you would.
Well, you know, and the thing about Orbison, I don't know what it was, but he had such an amazing...
Tell me.
And the fact that he was actually in the Traveling Wilburys, right, with Tom Petty, Jeff Lynne, George Harrison, Bob Dylan, and, you know, and it's incredible. What a lineup of people to be in.
I was all right for a while. I could smile for a while. But I saw you last night. You held my hand so tight. As you stop to say hello, or you wish me well, you couldn't tell that I've been crying over you, crying over you. Then you said so long, left me standing. I thought that I was over you. but it's true.